But I think because they have had such stringent guidelines for so long, they've caught more people. You know, I think track and field, as sexy a sport as it is, unfortunately, in the last couple of Summer Olympics, there's always been that taint, you know. So that is just a natural part of the Olympics now, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
That is a storyline that's unignorable, and you have to ask those questions. And, you know, for me, watching Michael Phelps win 8 gold in Beijing was just astonishing. I mean, that a guy could be that committed to that kind of excellence, and all of the what happened with him with the marijuana scandal was a pity, in a way, because I don't consider that a performance-enhancing drug necessarily. The guy was being an idiot, and he was partying, you know. So, but it doesn't change my mind about how great an Olympian he is, you know. And you know, tennis, my sport, for a long time, it was in the Olympics for a while, then it wasn't, and now it's back. Boy, oh boy, I have been saying forever, I mean, if I were a tennis player, a professional tennis player, and I had the chance to be an Olympian, I would take that in a heartbeat, because for all of the bad stories about steroids, about performance-enhancing drugs, and wondering, I mean, the idea that you could be wearing the flag, your nation's flag on your back, and performing, and in that kind of an arena, and that stuff still matters to me. And I still believe, maybe I'm naive, but I still believe that, you know, most athletes got there and earned their muscles, you know, the hard way.
One of the things that I think is sad about the coverage of the Olympics is just because of the fact that it's tied to ratings and making money, is that you only see the high-profile events that do have storylines that people are going to be interested in. But I think what Bud Greenspan has done over the years with his documentary really gives the true meaning of the Olympics. And I know that having covered it, you've had a chance, while it may not make the air, to see a lot of those stories. And I really think the Olympics are still there as they're supposed to be. We just don't happen to see them on network television.
Well, you know, I got to say, I've been working for NBC covering the Olympics. I work for CBS and covered a bunch of Olympics for them as well. But obviously now it's been on NBC for a long time, and I am amazed. We had something like 3,600 hours of coverage. I mean, it was just ridiculous. We could not have covered it more. And yes, there are sports that you had to look around for. You know, they obviously weren't all on the networks, but we had MSNBC coverage. We had CNBC coverage. We had, you know, USA Network coverage. Yeah, we basically, if there was a sport you felt like watching in Beijing, you got to watch it. I felt like we never closed. We just kept going. So I think technology has allowed us to show more and more stuff. But you're right, there are some sports that are sexier than others, that grab attention. We knew that swimming and gymnastics were going to be big headliners in Beijing. You know, in the past, figure skating, you know, Americans have done well in figure skating. Well, we're not as good as we used to be, but it's still, people are still going to tune in to watch figure skating and skiing, you know, the big sports. And you know, that's just part of it. I'm very happy, so there's not going to be some crazy time change. That 12-hour time, I was doing a late-night show in Beijing. You know, it was supposed to be like a midnight show. I was taping it at noon. You know, so it was hard to embrace that late night feel when I've just had my lunch, you know.
Well, there's a couple of things about the Olympics that I like, and that is the enduring images that one has. Now, let's see, Los Angeles, was it 80 or 84?
84, yeah.
84, and of course, I cannot forget the Swiss marathon runner staggering into the stadium, and the pain that I felt just watching something like that.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that I love about the Olympics, that it leaves that type of impression upon somebody.
Oh, that's an iconic image, and it was important because it was the first ever women's marathon. For so many years, it was thought that women were not capable of running a marathon. I mean, there were all kinds of petitions to get a women's marathon in the Olympics, so that was the first one. So when that Swiss woman staggered, you know, into the arena, into the stadium, and then barely made her way past the finish line and then sort of collapsed, you know, people like me were thinking, oh no, this could be bad for this. This might show that, you know, women can't do it. But in fact, it showed the humans. It showed the spirit. You know, it showed, and it ended up now. I mean, everyone knows that women can run marathons. But you're right. There are some images that you remember about the Olympics are of defeat. I've known for a long time, Ron, and so have you. Sometimes the best stories are in the loser's locker room,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. No, you're right about that. What does the documentary format give you as far as telling a story that maybe reporting on something that's only going to be 5 or 6 minutes long, or even doing something live? What is the different dynamic there?
Oh, it's such a luxury. You know, we get at HBO, we're given 10 months to develop and decide upon and create a story, to interview the people, the principals of the story, to edit, to write, to all, everything else. And it's such a luxury to be able to be patient, you know, to tell the story the way, you know, to frame it in a way you think might be revealing and important and will last a while. So it is a great, again, it's the ultimate form of storytelling to me.
Let me ask you about Dare to Compete, the struggle of women in sports. What was the challenge in telling that story?
Well, for me, I started off, and Ross Greenberg, my boss at HBO Sports, I was going to be a consultant on that. There were a couple of us who were going to, and of course, I walk in the first meeting, and it's Billie Jean was going to be a consultant, and Donna De Verona, the great swimmer who became an ABC, you know, an ABC sports reporter as well. And on the first day, I was just so loaded with ideas, and I kept spitballing them around the room, and we should do this, and we should do that. I have a million ideas. So Ross decided that, well, you know what, why don't we let her do some of these interviews that she insists we need to do? So he gave me the chance to do that, and then I got all excited about that, and I just kept going and going and going. Anyway, he kept giving me more and more latitude to be involved with this documentary, and finally, by the end of it, I went from being a consultant on the show to being a co-writer on the show. So that was my first experience. And I loved the process. And I just liked digging in like that and the history and all of the research it took and the history it took. And I just loved it so much. And now I'm lucky enough to be working on my fourth documentary in 4 years with Margaret Grossi, who's a tremendous producer. We did the Billie Jean King documentary, and we've done a Barbaro documentary, the great horse, the Kentucky Derby winner who ended up dying. And we did a golf documentary last year, and now we're working on Ted Williams. And the whole idea of just taking the time in this world of, you know, we all know what sports looks like now on TV. It's just bang, 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 and just very hot, quick cuts and edits and noises and explosions. It's kind of nice. It's sort of know that an important story is going to be before you and will unfold sort of patiently and intimately and with depth and clarity. You know what I mean? Not so much noise.
That
to me, maybe it's a function of age, but I'm of the age where I just tell me a good story.
Yeah.
Tell me something I don't know and explain it, you know, lay it out for me. And that's what documentaries mean to me.
In looking at the struggle of women in sports and able to take a look by being above it and telling that story, how far have women come and how important has sports been in the development of women overall and their abilities and also their, you know, the advantages that they've gotten in life in general?
Well, that's a great question. And the Billie Jean King documentary came out of the first documentary on the history of women in sports because Billie was fighting the fight so long ago, and she would take it to, everyone thought that the change would come from politics. Change would, you know, you had to take it to Capitol Hill. You had to take it to Washington. And Billie, her, you know, she just kept saying, it can come from sports. You know, if people see women doing, you know, competing, women athletic, women, you know, men will understand that, and women will think about that for the first time. Billie Jean's, you know, what Billie Jean didn't just want to get to men, you know, with her whole idea of equality. She needed to explain it to women as well. You know, look, you can do this. This is a birthright of yours to be an athlete. Sports is important to you. It changes your life. It affects the way you think. It affects the way you compete in every aspect of your life. And that was such an important message. And I got involved. Billie Jean King became my idol when I watched her play and beat Bobby Riggs in 1973. I was a 16-year-old, cross-legged, sitting on my living room floor watching my hero beat this guy. And, maybe it wasn't that big a deal for some people. It meant the world to me. It changed my whole life. And sports has changed my life.
One of the things about Billie Jean King, and knowing her as I do, is that a lot of people are never comfortable with being pioneers. But I've always had the sense about her in our late night conversations that she was comfortable with being a pioneer. She liked being Don Quixote.
Yes. Yes. Oh, boy, that's so right. And she was tilting at windmills, wasn't she?
She sure was.
In the same way that Michael Jordan wanted the ball with 3 seconds left, Billie Jean basically said, yes, I will be a pioneer. I will take the arrows in my back. I know they're coming. I know I'm going to be getting them. I will take them because it is worth it. This is important. And you're exactly right. I mean, Billie was, she's still, to my mind, one of the most important voices in my life. She still is that way for me.
Mary, one of the things that I found fascinating, and this kind of ties into what you're doing with Ted Williams, is that people like Billie Jean King and Ted Williams, they also have kind of interesting personalities as well. I mean, Ted Williams, I was a young sportscaster in Washington, D.C., when he was the manager there. And I remember the best conversation I ever had with him.
So he was older by then.
Yeah, he was older
he
by
was
then.
He was supposed to be mellower, was he?
Oh, no. But I'll tell you why I got along with him, because he was a lot like Vince Lombardi. I was in Washington there, too, and I've told this story about a young sportscaster. You can be intimidated by a Vince Lombardi. And I asked him after the team finished 7-7, I said, well, Coach, how does it feel to have a winning season? And he saw that I was young, and he took pity on me, and he looked at me. And he said, young man, you remember, I've never had a losing one.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's my Ted. He is a fascinator.
But the thing about Ted that I remember is I got along with him because the first thing I started talking to him about was fishing.
Oh, well, that would get him. That would reel him in.
That would reel him in.
Yes.
But
and,
what
and
was
he
it
loved
about,
fishing.
What
he
was
loved
it about his personality that made him so unique?
Well, I mean, it's so interesting to be reading about this because he was so complicated. He was.
Yes.
He had such strong appetites and so many fierce contradictions. He loved the roar of the crowd, but he loved the silence of the open water when he went fishing. He courted fame, but he hated celebrity. So he he wanted everyone to talk about him, but he also wanted everyone to shut up. Right?
Yep.
I mean, he was accused of not being a team player, but he was venerated for being a war hero. He was great to children, but not to his own children.
Right.
Yeah. And so, here's a guy, and he was the greatest ball, and he was going up at a time when DiMaggio was winning all those championships for the Yankees. And, Boston just couldn't win one, So it's... he's a very complicated man. He was a hero. He was an anti-hero. He's an absolute fascinating guy. So we're not in this documentary. We're calling it The Kid, The Life and Death of Ted Williams, because of course he had such an ignominious end. His son John
right.
Henry ended up freezing him. Believing in cryonics and believing in the possibility that his father could one day be unfrozen and come back. So. Unfortunately, a lot of people know that when you say Ted Williams, that's what they think about.
Well,
that's not what I think about, but a lot of people do. So we have to talk about that as well.
One of the things that I found is that he was very detail oriented. When we talked about bone fishing, and I still remember this, that he was as detailed about how to throw and how to cast and how to bring the fish in as he was when I talked to him about hitting.
Oh, absolutely. Well, the science of hitting, the science of casting, the science of hunting, if he was interested in something, and I think there was part of him, maybe, I didn't get to meet him. You did. You're lucky. So you would know this better than I, Ron, but, if there was something that interested in him, he just wanted to own it. He was
right.
always a little bit ashamed, I think, in reading about him, of the fact that he never went to college. So he didn't want people to think he was, he was dumb or he was ignorant, And there were some things, look, he became an incredible fighter pilot. you know, because he was interested in it.
Well, detail again also.
Detail, precision. Yeah. I mean, his all of his rules about the strike zone and not leaving it, you know. There were people who thought he was selfish because he wouldn't leave the strike zone to bring someone home, but he was adamant about it.
Mary Carrillo, a winner on and off the tennis court. Finally, noted sports broadcast historian and author Kurt Smith joins us. His latest book is about legendary Dodger broadcaster Vin Scully called Pull Up a Chair, The Vin Scully Story. In the book, Smith looks at how Scully's career started, who influenced him along the way, and looks at how he became the legendary broadcaster he is today. But I started by asking Smith this question. Kurt, when I saw that this book was coming out, the first thing I thought of, I wondered if it gave you any pause about writing about a man who has had such a legendary career and also is so esteemed that you might have taken a step back to consider what you were taking on.
In a word, yes, I did think of that because Vin Scully is not Joe Schmo. You're talking, and in this case, writing about someone who sets the bar extraordinarily high. He's the Roy Hobbs of baseball broadcasting, the best there ever was, for the reason that he plays the English language like Yasha Heifetz did a violin. So, Ron, the challenge for me, for any writer, would be to be as remotely and as literate in print as he is every night on the air. However, this is what I do. And as you suggest with Voices of the Game and what baseball means to me and a number of other broadcast books, I write about rhetoric. I write about language. And writing about language without a biography of Vin Scully would be like etching popular music and ignoring Sinatra, or World War II and ignoring FDR. It can't be done and shouldn't be done. And this is the fact in the end that propelled me to do a book that did give me pause. But then again, what a challenge writing about the best there ever was.
How did you want to present him?
Truthfully, this is a professional, not a personal critique. I did a book a couple years ago about my dear friend Mel Allen, whose story and odyssey were quite personal, a man who had all, lost all, then heroically came back. Ron Scully's story is the story that you and I hear every night behind the mic. How can anyone be this great for this long, 81 years old, record 60th straight year, as you alluded to, a play-by-play? Anyone listening to him on satellite radio knows that he hasn't lost a thing, which should, incidentally, be constitutionally forbidden, right? Everyone loses something at some age. He has not. And so what I wanted to do was, in essence, to ask and to answer the elusive question, what makes Scully Scully? Because, in a sense, you're trying to define genius, which can be rather ephemeral and elusive. It's like throwing darts in the fog. But I tried to do it with this book. We're in our fourth printing now. The reviews have been spectacular. I couldn't be more grateful to critics. And the nicest thing said to me was by our mutual friend Ernie Harwell, 91 going on 19, the great voice for so many decades of baseball. He called me and he said, you know, this is a book worthy of Vin.
Kurt, one of the things that I think probably posed a challenge for you, usually when an author writes a book, they get together with the person they're writing about and they work in a collaborative manner. That was not the case with Vin. First of all, why?
Modesty, privacy. He's Vin Scully. He doesn't need a book. Secondly, I think he wanted to avoid any focus on the personal as opposed to professional. I think as well, he had said for many years that he would never do a book. I believe him. He has said that he would never authorize an endorsed biography, as I said, or collaborate with a writer. I knew that because I had interviewed him for many prior books, including Voices of the Game and What Baseball Means to Me. My Scully archives were bulging even before I began the book, and I was not about to presume or intrude upon him by asking him to collaborate on a book. First of all, I don't like authorized biographies. Some may differ with me, but I think they have a connotation, if you would, if not being in the tank, at least losing credibility. I was not prepared to do that. I don't do authorized biographies. The only co-author I've ever had was George Herbert Walker Bush for 4 years when I was a White House presidential speechwriter. And so I called him because I've known him for so long. And had done a tribute with him to Red Barber, in fact, for Reader's Digest when Red died, him being Vin's mentor, really, in 1993. I told Vin, look, I'm not going to presume. I know you don't want a book. I said, but you have to take three things from me, Number one, it will respect his privacy. Number two, it would be, as I said, a professional, not personal critique. Number three, it will reflect my prior tenor of writings about him, and that is no one has ever done baseball like he has, and no one ever will. And, Ron, I can honestly say, and everyone who knows the book now knows this to be true, I kept my word, as I generally try to do.
Is it true that he is somewhat of a dichotomy? Now, I'm going to point out something that kind of indicated that to me. Was born in the Bronx, which is Yankee territory. He was a future Dodger broadcaster, but he grew up as a Giants fan.
Yes, I think that's a preview of coming attractions. This is a man, quite literally, in this case, Ron, who touched all the bases, and certainly a Renaissance man. And, you know, this is sort of prophetic in a sense, because he is a Renaissance man. Part of the Scully genius, part of the reason that you don't have to know baseball from bocce ball to admire and to hear him, is because he takes you far beyond the game. He has read incessantly since he was 7, 8, 10 years old, more often than not about things not related to sport, so that when the game is 20-1, he doesn't bore you with balls and strikes. He'll segue from Faulkner to the fielder's choice, or from Jimmy Durante to John Dunn, and he will stun you, as he did me as I was chronicling and cataloging the great phrases from his book. One night you'll hear him say, he catches the ball gingerly, like a baby chick falling from the tree. That's poetry. The next night, Vin will say it was so hot today the moon got sunburned. The next night, you'll hear him talk about a weak dribbler turned infield hit. He will quote Eugene O'Neill, a humble thing but thine own. Wonderful uses of the English language night after night. Winston Churchill often said that words are bullets you use as ammunition, and Vin uses them every night against any temptation to turn the dial.
Let me ask you a little bit about his background, because I think that's where the formation for who he is as a broadcaster and who he is as a person comes from. And I suppose we got to talk about Fordham University, because that's the education block in his background.
Yep. No question. That's a seminal event in his life. A wonderful school, of course, the Jesuit training, a focus on the learned and linear mind, nuanced, asking difficult questions and keeping asking until you find the solution. Vin is a very disciplined person and a very self-disciplined person. That comes probably from DNA. It also came from Fordham. And I think as well that he is a very religious person, and this comes from Fordham as well. So that if in fact a man is forged at a very early age, Scully had been. You know, he was the son of Irish immigrants, and his dad died at 4. And he had to scrap for everything he got. He worked his way through Fordham Preparatory School, then spent a year in the Navy, then returned to Fordham. And what did he do there? Oh, all he did was help found the campus radio station. He lugged a 25-to-30-pound tape recorder on campus around his back as he was broadcasting sotto voce, broadcasting to himself. He played center field. He simply didn't talk about the game. He played it. And he was very good field, no hit, and extraordinarily fast. His nickname, Ron, was the Phantom. And an anecdote that I've got in the book, which comes, in my case, under the rubric of Small World, 1947, he goes with Fordham to New Haven, Connecticut, to play Yale University. Yale's first baseman was also good field, no hit. His name? George Herbert Walker Bush. I often heard Bush talk about Scully with great fondness during the White House years. In fact, in the 90s, Bush cut a video for Scully, and this is what he said. He said, "Dear friend, when we talk about that game, remember two things. First of all, Yale won 2-1. Secondly, if I recall, we both went 0-3. I looked it up. He was right.
What did the Bronx background bring him in his life?
Well, the ability and necessity to work hard. He grew up in the Washington Heights section of northern Manhattan, within walking distance of the polo grounds and the big ballpark in the Bronx. And what did it bring him? It brought him the knowledge by age 8, Ron, what he wanted to do. He tells a wonderful story of how every Saturday afternoon at 1 p.m., he would go into the living room of the Scully fifth-floor flat. And as you'll recall from scholarship, in the 1930s and 40s, a lot of these radios were leviathans. They were gargantuan. They hovered 4 to 5 feet off the ground. So as Vin says, he would listen to Bill Stern do college football, and he would listen by taking some milk and crackers and a pillow, and Ron crawl under the radio. He would sit under the radio, as he said, let the sound wash over him. It was like he said water from a shower head. He was, at age 8, intoxicated by the crowd. 2 years later, the good Catholic nuns ask his classmates what they want to be. Most of them said doctor, lawyer, nurse, not. Vinny raised his hand, I want to be a sportscaster. So everything he did from then, talk about a fellow who was single-minded and focused like radar. He knew he wanted to speak, and he was intoxicated by the crowd, which meant that he would use the crowd as part of his arsenal. One thing that captivated me as I was doing the book and listening to more audio and video of him, Vin Scully is more eloquent saying nothing than many voices talking from A to Z. That's quite a trick.
When he got his break, it was with Red Barber. Tell the story that you tell in the book about the call that his mother got at home in 1949.
Scully, in 1949, he was 20 years old, 22 actually, not quite 22. And he was interning at WTOP Radio in Washington. Red Barber was the voice of the Brooklyn Dodgers, but also, Ron, this is key, the sports director of CBS Radio. So Barber interviews the intern, Vin Scully. And a couple weeks later, he needs a college football broadcaster to do Boston University and Maryland from Fenway Park. So he calls WTOP for references, and then he calls Scully home. And he gets his mother, red-haired and excitable, as Vin often said. So that evening, Mama beats Vin coming to the door. She says, and I'll paraphrase, what a wonderful thing. How exciting today was. This great man. What magnificence. He took the time to call. He wants you to call him. And Vin says, who was it, Mom? Mom says, Red Skelton. CBS's iconic comic. Of course, Vin knew it was not Skelton, and the last laugh was not on him. Next day, he called Red Barber. Barber gave him that assignment. Vin goes to Boston. He's expecting a booth. No booth. In fact, he had to broadcast from the roof of Fenway Park in freezing weather, carrying cable on the roof down the first baseline. Scully never complained. He, like Barber, was a stoic. And this impressed Barber as much as the quality of Vin's performance. So he calls him and he says, Vin, next week you'll have a booth, Harvard, Yale. Again, so impressive that off-season, Ernie Harwell left the Brooklyn Dodgers for the New York Giants. And who did Barber tap to replace him? Vin Scully, barely 22. To this day, incidentally, Harwell calls that, making room for Scully, his quote-unquote greatest contribution to the game.
The other thing, too, Kurt, that I think is interesting is the way, you know, with the Dodgers, that whole relationship of Vin Scully and the Dodgers came together, and it was something that was very comfortable. I mean, a guy that comes out of the Bronx, you would think would be a Yankee fan and everything, but I really felt that the Dodgers and Vin Scully were a hand-in-glove act.
Oh, I think that's true, and the irony is that Scully, his parents did not own a car. He had never been to Ebbets Field until the first day that he arrived to call a game. He'd been to the Polo Grounds with great frequency in Yankee Stadium, but not Brooklyn, USA. I agree with you. You used the term special, the relationship between Barber and Scully. It was. It was almost familial. It certainly was parental. And I think that Vin really looked upon Barber, as he often said, is the most profound influence, save his mother, in his life. Barber reciprocated. He said that Scully was the son I never had. So you're talking really about a surrogate dad. And the surrogate dad, as is so often the case, practiced tough love half a century, Ron, before that term arose. He would lecture Scully off and on the air. He would say things like, and I will try very poorly a Barber accent, now, young Scully, nobody cares what you think. As Red said, Vin didn't like it. He said the audience loved it. But he taught him not to socialize with players because you would lose objectivity. He taught him to be painstaking in terms of diligence, be accurate, never make a mistake, get to the ballpark hours before the game. He did. He taught him never to regard the Dodgers as an extended member of the family. Barber, like Scully, Ron, uses and used the exact same phrase. Each said, we have never, ever used the term we. So that when you hear Scully today on XM satellite or indeed from Los Angeles, when you hear him, you are really hearing Barber, except that you are hearing more. You are hearing the miracle of Vin Scully having transcended his mentor.
I think it's safe to say that Vin Scully has probably been associated with some of the greatest moments and probably more of the greatest moments in baseball than any other broadcaster. And certainly he has seen some significant events. And I want to take you back to Brooklyn with Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier. And I thought that one of the quotes was very, very interesting. He once said that Jackie was probably one of the few people in this world who excelled when he was angry. Talk to me about that event.
Yeah, most players, when they get angry, most humans lose perspective and lose effectiveness. We become less than we are. Jackie Robinson became more. As Scully said, this galvanized him, activated him to repay, not with violence, because Brant Rickey had swore him not to be violent, but rather through sheer excellence. Scully has said that if Robinson got hit by a pitch or was even thrown inside, he would automatically. How'd he get even? He'd steal second base, third base, he'd steal home plate. And he said that extraordinary self-discipline, much like Scully, in not responding to violence, but in really getting retribution by excelling and beating the other team. He said you were making the greatest mistake of your life if you made Robinson mad.
How did he react to the moving of the team to the West Coast? Because he was a New Yorker through and through.
Well, how would you react? Not well, and he did not either. Not in an open sort of way, but privately. After all, everything he loved was there. He was from New York. He was reaching and pleasing his public. In 1955, he had done the last 4.5 innings on NBC television of Brooklyn's first, and as it turned out, sadly, sole world title. And Scully, on the last out, which is a ground ball from Pee Wee Reese to Gil Hodges, said simply, "Ladies and gentlemen, the Brooklyn Dodgers are the champions of the world." Then hushed. All winter, people would ask, "How did you remain so calm?" And Scully said, "If I had said another word, I would have broken down and cried." He didn't want to go in 57. Why would he? As he said, he was like the wife whose husband had been transferred. She doesn't want to go, but she goes. And yet the irony, Ron, as you know and many of your listeners do, the Dodgers westward ho, leaving Brooklyn for Los Angeles in 1957, the early part of 58, was in fact the most fortuitous turn of events that could possibly have happened, because Scully became an institution in Los Angeles, became the embodiment of the town then and now to an extent that he never could have in the city of New York.
Let's talk also, before he leaves New York, about the 1956 World Series and the perfect game, because he was right there with his broadcasting partner, Mel Allen, and they saw perfection.
They sure did. Don Larson, October 8, 1956, first a perfect game in baseball since the early 20s, first and only a perfect game in World Series to this day. And here he is with Mel Allen, the legendary marquee celebrity voice, the most famed broadcaster in the country. And Scully's kid, still living with his parents. And he does the last 4.5 innings, and, of course, the extraordinary pressure. Each man up, each man out, 27 in the end in a row, retired by Larson. And Scully called the final out, and then he began to leave the booth. He was that dazed, if you would, like everyone. And Allen says, "Vin, aren't you going to give the final score?" And then he does, of course. But as Vin says, and I recall this in the book, Pull Up a Chair, he said that his suit felt like a greenhouse. He was wilted, soaked through and through.
Did he have any kind of idea about what the West Coast was going to be like?
No, nor did the West Coast have any idea what he was to be like. You know, interestingly, Alder O'Malley, the Dodger owner, was pressured by people in Los Angeles not to hire him, to hire two local people. But O'Malley, who also had, it's interesting, that sort of father-son relationship with Scully, had implicit faith in him. And justifiably so, he goes to the West Coast, and here you have Los Angeles then like now totally sprawled out, no focal point, no epicenter, with the transistor radio having been invented only 3 to 4 years earlier, or at least made commercially available. The Dodgers played, talk about confluence, their first 4 years at gargantuan Los Angeles Coliseum, where if you were sitting in the last row of the center field bleachers, you were 700 feet from home plate. So literally, you couldn't see the infield. As a result, tens of thousands of Angelinos began bringing transistor radios to the Los Angeles Coliseum to hear Scully tell them what they could not hear. He became known as the Transistor Kid. He spurred the sale of radios probably more than any person in the country. To an extent, when the Dodgers left the Coliseum in 1962 for Dodger Stadium, Ron, as you know, the tradition continued, bringing transistors to the game. It endures to this day.
How did he make the transition, and how did he feel about making the transition to television?
Well, he's always considered himself a child of radio, and if you listen to him today on television, he still brings a radio view, a radio word picture. Nobody more seamlessly weds anecdote and play-by-play than him, and he does it in a very funny way. For example, Andre Dawson makes the disabled list, and Vin said he's day-to-day, and then he adds after pausing, but then again, aren't we all? Brilliant, ad-lib, what Hemingway would call grace under pressure, at 81, going on 21, nobody like him, never will be again.
One of the things that I like about him on television is that he didn't let television change him. I mean, his personality on radio is what established him as a great broadcaster. And sometimes people try to become kind of televisionish, and that's not what he is.
That's not him. He's never thought he was bigger than the event. Even when in 1974 he does Henry Aaron's homer number 715, Bill Buckner's error, the 86 World Series, Kirk Gibson heroically going deep 2 years later. What do you hear? You hear reserve, you hear self-discipline, you hear Scully receding, you hear him after those events. He literally got up from the mic, went to the back of the booth, and what does he do? Like he's 8 years old, he lets the crowd sound hold sway.
Another observation, and if I'm wrong about this, feel free to correct me, but I believe that maybe he realized that his love for baseball was the sport that he should stay with. Now, I would listen to him doing football on CBS, and I always thought it never quite worked. Maybe it was because his image was so strong with baseball, and the things that he said had a particular rhythm that worked with baseball, but maybe not so much with football. Am I correct in that observation?
I think you're correct, Ron. Keep in mind that in a three-hour baseball game, and I know this because I've timed it, as have others as well, three-hour baseball game, the ball may be in play for 7 to 8 minutes. So you'd better be able to fill that air. And Scully, in essence, fills that air by using the oar of language as a paddle to navigate. That's not true with other sports. Hank Greenwald, a great announcer, once told me, basketball and football, they carry the announcer. In baseball, the announcer carries the sport. Bingo. That's exactly how it is. And so in a game like baseball, with the lulls and the silences, you have a chance, as Vin does. He's been called the F. Scott Fitzgerald of Major League Baseball, an estimate I think not far wrong. He gets a chance to use the wonderful allusions and similes. He gets the chance to talk about Rennie Stennett, for example, of the Pirates, who was once passing out cigars in the clubhouse. He was sure his wife, about to have a baby, would have a boy. Well, of course, it was a girl, said Vin on the air. He only missed by one. Well, maybe he doesn't get a chance to do that with golf or tennis and certainly football. I write in the book about something that I don't think is well known. When Vin went to CBS in the 1970s, he was promised the NFL number one broadcast job on the television side of Columbia. And he did, I think, a fine job. People forget that he was the voice behind the catch, and that is Dwight Clark's catch, January of 1982, San Francisco 28 over the Cowboys 27 in the last couple minutes. But Scully, friends insist, Vin, of course, will not say, they say he was promised the Super Bowl. Well, along came a supernatural force by the name of John Madden, who, like Vin, also liked to talk. And CBS began to worry that there was simply too much verbiage. You can't ask Vin to stop talking. It's what he does best. And Madden would never stop talking, even if you asked. So what they did was, Ron, they paired Scully and Madden in several games. Then they paired the more laconic, Spartan pedestrian in Pat Summerall with Madden for several games. They came to the conclusion, and I think a right conclusion, that the mix of Madden and Summerall was better.
If there is one thing that has allowed him to have such a long career, and I think you and I both know this, that when it comes to play-by-play announcers in baseball, they talk about what goes first in a pitcher, and usually it's his legs. In the case of broadcasters, it's usually their eyes. And I know that there have been broadcasters like Harry Carey who would make a call in the latter stages of his career where he would almost think it was going to be out of the ballpark for it to fall short of the warning track.
Yet
he's never had that sort of problem as old as he is. Why do you think he's been able to technically and health-wise be able to be extraordinary as well?
Well, as I said earlier, the amazing, it should be unconstitutional thing, he hasn't lost a thing. You're right about sight. Sight is God's gift, and it leaves us when it does. Byram Saum for the Phillies in the mid-70s had to retire in essence because of sight. He couldn't see the ball against the AstroTurf. One night in St. Louis, this is the play-by-play, he said, "There's a ground ball to shortstop, and it's gone." Well, he announced his retirement not long afterward. Other broadcasters lose their voice. I mean, we all lose the voice from time to time, but when you're doing baseball game in and game out and you're in your 70s, we hear it. We hear it as they broadcast. It's a bit weaker. The vocal cords are not as strong. It's not as resonant. And we accept that. That has not happened with Vin as well. Sometimes memory goes. That hasn't happened with Vin as well. I think why? Because I think he takes care so well of himself. I think he has good genes. In this sense, the Irish DNA has served him well. But I don't believe that he ever drinks, or if he does, very sparingly. He gave up smoking 30 to 35 years ago. He walks. He exercises to some extent. He is endlessly curious. This matters as well, because you can become mentally ill and then physically ill after that. Scully is still as inveterate a reader at 81 as he was at 18. And I submit, and I have got in the book about a half a page of some of the books that he reads, and almost none of them involve sport.
I want to ask you about one other aspect, because I think it's another key to his longevity and his great success, and that is anticipation. He has announced a record 25 World Series, 18 no-hitters, also Hank Aaron's 715th homer in 74, Bill Buckner's 86 era, and Kirk Gibson's improbable deep home run in the 1988 World Series. Tell me a little bit about that anticipation. Is it instinct? Is it his love for the game? It is a combination of all of that.
He knows the game exceedingly well. There's an anecdote in the book, 1983, he and Joe Garagiola joined one another for Game of the Week. And Scully and Garagiola had had a rather frosty relationship before. And I quote Vin turning to Garagiola and said, "Joe, if you're going to talk inside baseball, you tell that to the fans, but you don't tell it to me." He said, "I've played and broadcast as many games as you played in the majors." And he probably had. For sure he had. Plus, Vin had the confidence that as a player at Fordham, he knew the game. So I think this fuels that anticipation. Secondly, the curiosity. What will happen? What are the various possibilities and gradations on any play? I think that enters into it. I think Scully is endlessly and mentally curious. I can't prove this, and I've never asked him. But as he's looking at a play, I am sure that he is, in his own mind, mentally mulling, well, what anecdote, if something happens, might I bring to this? You know, it's almost as if no matter what the situation on the field, he has in the memory bank an anecdote, a dowry. For example, if it's an infield fly, he'll press the button, anecdote number 752, infield fly. No one can match that, and no one does. I talked to Dick Enberg, and it turns him green. He says, and he likes Vin very much, but he says, how does he do it? How does he take any play and immediately and instantly add the punctuation mark, the quotable quote, the line, the anecdote? You mentioned Gibson in 88. What was the line he said after the home run, which, of course, shocked the entire country? Vin says, "In a year that has been so improbable, the impossible has happened."
And I think the reason for that is the fact that he stays ahead of the game. I've never seen him either on top of it or behind it. He's always ahead of it. Would you agree with that statement?
Yes, he is a man of the present, I think. And he quoted, I think it was Eugene O'Neill once saying, "There is no past or there or present. There is the past over and over and over again." And he's been there. You talked about his history. I can make a case that in the last 60 years, his history is largely baseball's history. Game of the Week, Dodgers, World Series, All-Star Game. But no matter the event, he is, as I said, as timelessly as now. For example, he's 80, and I'm listening. And this is what he says when a heavily sideburned player with massive mutton chops enters the game. And out of the blue, I hear Scully forging straightaway poetry. He says, "What ho, what ho, what men are these who wear their sideburns like parentheses?" No, Ron, they don't teach that in Broadcasting 101.
What do you think his legacy will be?
I can give you the legacy. John Miller gave it to me, the great broadcaster for the Giants and ESPN. He said, there's not a thing that Vin Scully does that I would not totally recommend to an aspiring radio or television journalist. And that's about as good a legacy, and I think it's right.
Kurt Smith, a great writer capturing the greatness of Vin Scully in Pull Up a Chair, The Vin Scully Story. I hope you've enjoyed U.S. Airways' in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, and you'll listen to our live broadcast on radio, the American Forces Network worldwide, Sirius XM satellite radio, and the Internet. And if you'd like a listing of Sports Byline USA's radio affiliates, be sure to check our award-winning website. You'll find that at sportsbyline.com. I'm Ron Barr, and thanks for being a part of America's sports talk show, Sports Byline USA.